So here we are at the start of the afternoon session. And this morning we were in the territory of insight practice, and we were looking at particularly the power of concepts and the importance of separating out concepts from actual experience. And we did one of those basic exercises going through the senses, and it was slightly impure just sitting because we were using a kind of filter of what is my direct experience here to do that. And then we had questions, and we got as far as, well, we left Ananta hanging in midair. Hope you've been all right up there for the last few hours. And Ananta was asking about that tendency to feel a split between the experiencer and the content of experience. Is that a fair summary of the general area? So let's look at that for a bit. And we saw this morning that there's a whole aspect to insight practice which involves looking at assumptions, seeing through assumptions, and peeling back the the wallpaper of concepts, some of which has been there for a very long time, most of our lives. And so we no longer notice it. And as we do that, we get back to quite basic building blocks of thought. So we're just starting to talk about boundary issues. Quite basic building blocks of thought, out of which we build up a world. And those basic building blocks, often we don't question. So, for instance, this is where someone like Nagarjuna comes into play, really, because he questions even basic things like coming and going, or unity and diversity, because they're all concepts out of which we're creating a sense of, well, through which we're making sense of the world. And one of those basic ways of looking at things is in terms of boundaries and divisions, comparison, and one of the most fundamental ones is self and other. So, of the various aspects of insight, one important one is seeing that there's no self in the five skandhas. Another very important one is seeing non-duality, that sense of me in here confronted by the world out there is another conceptual construct. Because an awful lot of our existential suffering, that sort of third level of dukkha, arises out of a sense of being separate, cut off, existentially alone, confronted by a world that's somehow other. But that isn't how things are. That's just how we're interpreting things, how we're making sense of things. In a way, we're confusing the map for the territory. It's a bit like when I went for a walk up Oyster Hill with the Pyre a couple of days ago. Looking out, well, on one side there were the Malverns, and then we could look out, and in the distance we could see hills which were Welsh hills, I think. I think you can see that far. And so, yeah, here we were in England, and over there were the Welsh hills. But those English hills and Welsh hills, they don't know that they're English hills and Welsh hills. Yeah. It's not like the English ones, you know, all have kind of white grass, you know, with big kind of St. George red crosses on them. And then you cross a certain border and suddenly, you know, it's all kind of red and there are dragons on the hills. And that's not how it is, yeah? There's just seamless continuity of landscape. But, yeah, some many hundreds of years ago, we drew boundaries, and at a certain point, England stops and Wales begins. But that boundary is conceptual, and it can shift. It's like the boundary between England and Scotland. You know, Scotland is part of Britain, but it may not be if a referendum goes a certain way. So similarly, we are making a distinction between me in here and everything else out there. But when we look, although that's based on something, fundamentally we're bringing ideas of self and other to the experience. When we get right down to actual experience, we don't find self, we don't find other. Just as we don't find England, we don't find Wales. We just find hills and grass and trees. And that sense of self, a lot of the time it's identified with all the five skandhas. I'm there, so to speak, here, you know, and I stop where the body comes to an end. And all that is me, in a great sea of other. And at other times, we may even just identify with some of the five skandhas. So there are times where, you know, something in the body goes wrong, and I feel like, oh, you know, me in here feels like the body is letting me down now. And I'm not the body, the body is something that I'm unfortunately attached to that is causing me problems. Feelings, some of the time feelings are me, but again, I may just feel that feelings are things that I have. And so on. And probably when it comes down to it, our most basic level of identification is with awareness. So in meditation, for instance, quite often we make the sort of fundamental split that we come up against, which again isn't a real split, but feels as if this is how it is between me, the meditator, me the witness of experience and experience. So to put that another way, there's awareness and everything that appears within awareness. And we identify ourselves with the awareness as subject and the appearances as object. And funnily enough, a lot of meditation practice that we do strengthens that sense of the witness, the meditator, the one who's directing the process. And to some extent that needs to happen. We start with, so to speak, an unaware or a rather dimly non-reflexively aware experience. Yeah. When we're really dull, for instance, there's experience, but we don't even know really what's going on. We're just a bit lost in the experience. Then we create, you know, a self-aware, knowing aspect, which can then direct the process of dependent arising, or to some degree. But that then gets quite split off. So we have, you know, me the meditator, me the witness of experience. And finally we have to dissolve that away again. And when we do that, or when that happens, there's just aware experience. And there's no particular sense of me separate from the experience. And then we're really in the flow of life. And again, as with selfing, we can get a sense of this just through the day, or in certain experiences. The example I often use is doing communication exercises. I don't know how much they still get done. For many years they were a great way of sort of emptying your Buddhist centre, and now it's the after the tea break we should be doing communication exercises. And suddenly people all had important things that they had to go off and do. And actually back in the 1970s they were really popular. We used to do these weekends. We'd do, you know, a couple of hours on one afternoon and a couple of hours on the next afternoon. I mean, they were all mixed, and most of us were in our 20s, and, you know, we'd have a great time just gazing into one another's eyes. Sometimes I felt like, you know, my Christmases had come at once. Being encouraged to just spend five minutes gazing into this person's eyes. Anyway. Very often, if you do something like that, you start off, and yes, perhaps you haven't done the exercises very much yourself, and you sit down opposite somebody who you don't know very well, and in that situation, it's as if you become acutely self-aware. Yeah, it's almost like you're there with the other person, but you're sort of resisting being there, and it feels like you're really kind of emotionally distanced from them. And there's a lot of thinking about, oh, I wish I'd brushed my hair before I sat down, and oh, what are they thinking about me, and all that, yeah, going on. But then, okay, you start talking to them and you discover that actually they're just another human being, and they're all right. And the thing starts to soften a little bit. And then you get talking some more and you do some of the exercises, and you start getting really interested and you find points of communication and common ground. And after a while, you're really kind of enjoying it. And that sense of them out there softens and softens. And it's like you get more and more engaged in the communication. And that sense of subject-object also sort of softens. It's as if you start to sort of melt into one another. You may not get very far, but... So just as through the day there's this opening and closing, tightening around, opening out. So that sense of subject-object is getting stronger or softer, stronger or softer. There are times where, you know, if I completely lose what I'm talking about and I think, and I suddenly think, oh, there's 50-odd people looking at me now, you know, suddenly I feel I'm here, the anxiety-wrecked sort of subject faced with all of you. But then, you know, I sort of find my flow again and look around and they're all very friendly, kind people. And that sense of, yeah, you know, me talking to you, that sort of disappears pretty much. So that's, do you see what I mean? So it's not like there is actually any fixed boundary. There's a self-othering that we set up, a self-othering that we do. But the fact that it does flow, again, shows that there isn't anything fixed there. So we can look into all that. And we can deconstruct that. And there are, to some extent, we do it just by kind of relaxing out of it. Yeah, that's what happened with the communication exercises. We started tense, we weren't sure, so there was a strong sense of them sitting opposite me sitting opposite them. But then we got into more communication, we relaxed, it became easier. Well, it's a bit like going and watching a film, you know, and you're not sure how it's going to be, and the first few minutes you're kind of a bit distanced, but then, oh, actually it's really good. And without quite noticing it, sort of imperceptibly, you sort of become the film. Or you listen to the music, and you are the music while the music lasts, as it says in The Wasteland. No, Four Quartets. So, yeah, relaxation. You can. It's almost like you can relax, just relax out of the subject-object duality. But then you can also examine you can look at where you feel like the boundary is and almost sort of peel away the concepts from that, and you may be able to get through it that way. Or you can look at the me the meditator, me the experiencer, and see, well, what's that made up of? And it may be quite subtle, but just by, in a light way, almost like putting that question, just dropping that question, so there's a little kind of subtle observing going on of the observer to see what's there. When it's less subtle, you can sort of almost see a sequence. It's like, yes, okay, let's go into this. Yes, let's do this bit and then we'll see where we are with questions. There's an English Dzogchen teacher called Rigzin Shikpo who has an image which I think is very helpful. He describes a stage which has a director's chair in front of it. And so this director's chair is empty and the stage is. But then onto the stage come actors, one after another. And this is an image for the stage, is, we can say, is the stage of awareness. It's the stage of mind. And across that stage come thoughts and feelings. And a lot of them pass across the stage. So you're meditating on the breath, say, and there's some thought about, did I sign up for today to wash up? Or Vijayamala wanted somebody, didn't she? Could I do that? And that just sort of comes and goes. Hopefully after the meditation you act on it, but while it's happening, I'm doing my best for you here. while it's happening, yeah, that thought just comes and goes, and you're not identified with it. Yeah, it's just a passing thought. Yeah? Or you can have a passing feeling, passing sensation. But then there are certain thoughts and feelings to which you give VIP status. There are certain thoughts and feelings which you identify as me. So, and the image that Rigsin Shikpo uses is certain actors come onto the stage and they don't just pass off, they sit down in the director's chair. And they say, right, you, no, sorry, we're trying to meditate, you know, no thoughts, thank you very much. Yeah. But, and that feels like me, you know, me has appeared, you know, me is taking charge of this meditation. But actually, there is no director, there are just more actors who come and sit in the director's chair and then they pass on. You get the image. It's like, you know, when we start to find, to look at what me consists of, we can only find the five skandhas. Yeah? So, and usually we're identifying with thoughts and feelings and the sort of awareness that goes with that. And that awareness is always a divided awareness. It's always a vijnana, not a jnana, not a wisdom, not a timeless awareness, because we're identified. And when I'm identified with this, I'm automatically not identified with that. So, that's some thoughts in answer to Ananta's question, really. So, how much of that did you get? And what needs clarifying? Talking about insults to the ego, you know, like day one you discover how tired you are, you know, day two you discover you're not deeply in touch with your heart, and day three you discover you kind of limits of your understanding of reality, and there it is. Anyway. Nayaka. Yeah.
It seems to me that concept, we often use concepts to describe our experience after it's arisen.
Yeah.
So even when concepts fall away in the mind, there's still a lot of volitional processes going on, and I suppose craving, aversion, all that still kind of rolling out. It's just that it's not. I'm not necessarily forming concepts to sort of describe it or define it or develop it, but it's still kind of there.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, that's why there's the path of vision and the path of transformation, even. It's like, you know, as some people are discovering quite a lot at the moment, you know, even if you have an insight into no self to some degree, whatever degree it may be, that doesn't set everything right with the world. It's like those volitional tendencies, they still keep on going. Yeah. Although it does make a difference. You know, it's the difference between if I feel I'm clenching around me, and am I going to be all right? To start with, you know, if I believe if I cling to a self, it's like, you know, there's a self in the middle of this, and I'm protecting it and looking after it, and there's a lot of tension. At a certain point, I realise, no, there is no self, but still, under a lot of circumstances, there will just be clenching. It's clenching around nothing, but there's still that tendency to clench. So a lot of the post-insight work is just to relax physical tensions and all that kind of mechanism that has been set going by all the belief in self over all those years, if you see what I mean. So that's the big picture. And the small picture is, yes, you know, the sanya creates, you know, conditions, volitional movements, and those carry on, even though, you know, the concepts which condition them have passed away. Does that help at all?
I think so. I think there's a big gap between my sort of lack of concepts and seeing through self, right enough. I suppose the message I get is that, well, actually, it's just has to unfold slowly over time at more simple levels.
Yes, I guess that's probably a message in the right direction. Yeah.
Can I ask?
Dominic.
It's a bit unclear, but I'll try. I'm appreciating I'm going to need to really cut down on to my addiction of I and me in my language. I might manage to get it down to 100 a day. but I was thinking, I very much believe in me becoming. And if I get too much rid of myself, I might forget, well, that's fine, I don't want to really become, so maybe that's a good thing. But the reason this is on my mind is because, this is related, but because of this retreat, last night I had a very open sort of dreams. And in my dream, a figure came, and it was the kind of person you wouldn't really want to meet in a dark night. And I had no problem, because I was so relaxed. Every time it came too close, I just relaxed out of it. When you use that language, I just relaxed out of it. And he actually turned around and started liking me. And then he took off. And to me, this is like a dead spirit. But what happened was I thought, oh, that it's like he was a sort of like a psychic momentum, really attached to having a self. And he couldn't let it go. And I thought, flipping heck, it's so important to loosen up on this self-image that I had. You know, when we die, we need to be able to sort of let go of that one of the momentum and not be... So I realise it is a very important issue, and all I'm saying is, but I still think, though, I'm so habituated to, especially when I'm writing to Shabda and things like that, I like to, you know, I have to try and just be a bit more subtle and a bit more... just pay more attention to try and loosen it up a bit. I suppose really, it is more like a comment. I'm just find it interesting that there's this thing that's been coming up about re-becoming, and apparently some people don't realise that we don't have a choice in this unless we're very developed. And it seems to somehow connect us a bit.
Yeah. Well, a couple of comments on your comment then. I mean, it's probably, I guess it's not so much how often you use the word I, but it's more the awareness with which you use it, because if it's just a description of what's happening with these psychophysical processes, that's all right, it's not a problem. And if it's an expression of strong identification, then that is a problem, because we'll be driven by that, and yes, we'll be driven, if we take the traditional view, we'll be driven by the volitions that creates into an enforced rebirth or re-becoming, which gives us no freedom, no say in the matter, just as, you know, if I'm completely sort of lost in a mood or something, I have no say in how I'm going to act over the next 2 minutes. I'm just driven along. It's the same process. So one would like to be free to have choice, just as one has choice, would like to have the freedom from that drivenness to be able to choose here. So one would like to be able to choose if there's going to be re-becoming, for that re-becoming to be a re-becoming at the service of the Dharma, at the service of living beings, and yeah, that really to be how things went. Thank you, Matty.
Just a question to clarify, really. So you said a little while ago that our most basic identification is with awareness. Mm. And then in this image of the stage, of Richard Chimpo's, you're describing awareness as the stage. we're identifying with a particular thought and feeling that's sitting in this director's chair. Mm. So you're suggesting we're not identifying with the stage, we're identifying with a particular experience.
A lot of the time, as I said, we can identify with more than one of the five skandhas, if you like. So if we look at, you know, what we're identified with, we'll find that we're identified with this thought about and this feeling, and we don't particularly notice it, but we're also identified with the awareness that's having this thought and this feeling. I agree, the image sort of breaks down when you start thinking about the actors, you know, being identified with the stage. Right. It's a bit weird, but...
So you sort of identify with both a particular thought, feeling, and the awareness.
Yeah. And one way out of all this is to practice expanding awareness beyond the confines of the physical body. And that's part of what we're doing with just sitting. Yeah? It's like we're actually, because we're not choosing to particularly focus on the body, the thoughts, you know, my body, my thoughts, my feelings, da-da-da-da, or even my friends, my relatives. We're just letting awareness fall open. We're just letting it be completely open. So it's taking in a lot of what we usually think of as other. So we're not prioritizing certain experiences which we think of as me. We're practicing an awareness which doesn't prioritize. And one way into this is to just be aware, in a rather Yogacara way, that there is just experience. So, there is just experience through the six senses. And when we look at in that way, then all experience that we're having is equally our experience. It's sort of undivided. Yeah. It's not that we're just saying... Usually when we're operating in terms of self and other, of the six senses, we're saying touch touches me, because that's the body. Sound, no, that's me, that's other, that's out there. Sight, that's other, that's out there. Taste, smell, they're, well, the contents are out there. And the mental sense, well, that's all me. Yeah, so we get about sort of 3 out of 6 of me, or maybe 4, 3.5 out of 6, and 2.5 out of 6 are other. Yeah. But if we're aware that actually this is all our experience, it's all the contents of our awareness. Yeah. If rather than just identifying with some of the senses, we either don't identify with any of them, or we identify with all of them, then suddenly we're in a world where that self-other thing has gone away. Do you get that? No. Because everything, from a Yogacara point of view, everything is an experience of awareness. Yeah. If there's no awareness, no experience, by definition. If there's no awareness, nothing. Yeah. So we have experience of, and therefore awareness of feeling the body, of hearing, of seeing, of tasting, of touching, and of cognizing, of, you know, sort of feelings, images, memories, fantasies, etc. So all that's happening within awareness. And often these kind of approaches, they ask you to really become interested in what awareness is in and of itself. And then if you get to that point, a rough example is that awareness is like a sort of field, yeah, within which, this is a slightly different version of the stage analogy, but anyway. Yeah. And within that field of awareness, anything can arise. And usually we're identified with just part of the field. But if we were identified with everything which arose, all the appearances to awareness, then there would be no divisions, there would be no split. So it's difficult to talk about this. It's all, you know, you kind of have to keep using analogies and things, which will only go so far. So, if you look from this point of view, there's a little kind of summary which you get in the Mahamudra tradition, which says, everything is mind, first off, number one. Everything is mind. Everything is awareness, we could say. Yeah. As far as we're concerned, at least. Yeah. So that's the sort of Yogacara point of view. Everything is our experience, which is always an experience of awareness, an experience of mind. So everything is mind. Secondly, mind is shunya, mind is empty, mind is ungraspable. So you have that's more of a sort of Majjhimaka viewpoint, just in case we were going to turn mind and awareness into some kind of entity or a thing. Yeah? Mind's ungraspable because you can't get hold of awareness, can you, in itself. You can't say where it is. You can't say when it is. It's more fundamental than any of those questions. So mind is ungraspable. And then mind appears in endless, unobstructed forms. So awareness, so to speak, can take on appearance of a microphone, it can be a sound, it could be a pain in your knee, it could be all sorts of things. So what that's saying is that awareness and appearances aren't separate. And coming back to Ananta, usually what we do is we separate out the two. How we talk about things to ourselves is, it's a bit like there's the observer, the knower, the watcher, the experiencer, sort of in here, back in here somewhere, having an experience, which is out there sort of separate in some sort of way. So it's a bit like if you have a film projector and it shines light onto a screen, so we identify with the projector and then there's the appearance of the film out there. Yeah? But actually it's a bit more like if you have a computer screen, say, where the screen's made up of pixels and they light up themselves to produce the awareness, to produce the image of the film. So it's not like there's me back here, the observer, the awareness, and out, and somehow out there are the appearances. They're actually, the appearances are themselves awareness. The awareness is itself the appearances. Sorry, we've got into rather deep water here. Maybe we won't go much further with it. But is this helping? Is anyone? Yeah.
I was struggling with the metaphor a bit, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Is it similar to what you were saying this morning about standing on the bank and looking,
rather
than being in the flow?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I found that analogy very helpful, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of simple. It's immediate, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. They're all different analogies to help us recognize that our experience is not divided in the way we think that it is, that actually our experience is, we're creating a split. And it's not a real split, just as there isn't a real self. So we never are cut off from the rest of the world. We never are existentially alone, really. We just think we are. Actually, everything's okay. Yeah. So we need some sort of analogy by which we're in the stream all the time and we just think we're standing on the bank. But because we think we're standing on the bank, then we suffer. I can't quite work out what that analogy is, but
it's like we need to convince ourselves over and over.
Yes, in a way, yeah. And we partly do that by just keeping looking at our experience. You know, it's like if you, in meditation, you can look at, well, you know, that sense of me, what's that made up of? Is it, you know, okay, there's tension in the body, there's thoughts, there's strong emotions. What else is there, you know? Is there more to that sense of me that feels real than just those things? Yeah. And we also we set up the conditions by things like metta, positive emotions. One of the features of positive emotions is that when we're in a state of positive emotion, that sense of subject-object duality is less. And, yeah. Negative emotions create a stronger sense of split, a stronger sense of the reality of me that needs to be whatever it needs to be in that moment. Yeah. So metta, for instance, yeah, it creates a softening of that subject-object duality, and if we take it far enough, it can even produce experiences of non-duality. Which is why, you know, sometimes with insight practice, people take it as quite sort of cognitive and a bit kind of cold, and we just sort of look at experience, you know. And that's not really the most helpful way to do it. The most helpful way to do it is really in a context of positive emotion and a lot of relaxation. So, yeah, in that way you're setting up the conditions for it. And, yeah, it helps to bring about experiencing how things really are. And it also makes the ride kind of less bumpy, sort of up to and after that experience. Okay, that's probably plenty. So, even if we don't quite get these things, even just taking them in, taking in those images, those analogies, and just reflecting, it does pull the carpet out from under a certain kind of belief in this is how things are, and when how things are is rather different. So let's do a little meditation.